Chapter 15. Putting the System on Trial. Command Complicity. This type of behavior of the accused MPs has long-term impact, including, and lastly, it has the impact on soldiers, our soldiers and sailors and Marines, airmen who may be captured in the future, and their treatment. And I'll leave it at that. The prosecutor continues to make evident that what is at stake in this and the other trials of the Abu Ghraib 7 is nothing less than the honor of the military. Finally, sir, the honor of our United States Army is both precious and perishable. We have a sacred trust in the United States Army, of all armies, but in particular our Army, is that we bear this great responsibility and power, the power to impose force on others. And the only thing that separates us imposing power unjustly and becoming a rival, a mob, a group of thugs, is that we have this sense of honor that we do what's right. We follow those orders that are given to us, and we do the honorable thing, and this behavior, the Abu Ghraib prison abuses and torture, degrades that. And we also, just like any other army, we need a moral high ground as well to rally ourselves. My closing statement in the Frederick trial was spontaneous and unscripted. It foreshadowed some key arguments that will be developed in this chapter, which provides fuller scope for the theses that powerful situational and systemic forces were operating to cause these abuses. Moreover, in the time since that trial, October 2004, further evidence has emerged that clearly shows the complicity of a host of military commanders in the abuses and torture on Tier 1A, Abu Ghraib Prison. Here is the text of my statement. The Fay Report, the Taguba Report, indicate that this abuse could have been prevented had the military put in any of the resources or any of the concern that they're putting into these trials. Abu Ghraib never would have happened. But Abu Ghraib was treated with indifference. It had no priority, the same low priority in security as the archaeological museum in Baghdad, whose treasures were looted after Baghdad was liberated while soldiers passively watched. These are both low priority military items, and this one happened to erupt under these unfortunate circumstances. So I think that the military is on trial, particularly all of the officers who are above Sergeant Frederick, who should have known what was going on, should have prevented it, should have stopped it, and should have challenged it. They are the ones who should be on trial. Or if Sergeant Frederick is responsible to some extent, whatever his sentence is, has to be, I think, mitigated by the responsibility of the whole chain of command. In this chapter, our path will follow several different directions that should lead us to draw out from behind the dark screen of concealment the central role of many key players in the drama at Abu Ghraib, the directors, scriptwriters, and stage managers who made this tragic play possible. In a sense, the MPs were merely bit actors, seven characters in search of an author or a director. Our task is to determine what were the systemic pressures that existed outside of the situation that existed inside Abu Ghraib's hard site of interrogation. We need to identify the particular parties involved at all levels in the chain of command for creating the conditions responsible for the implosion of human character in those MPs. In presenting the chronology of these intertwined forces, I will switch roles from that of defense expert to that of prosecutor. In that capacity, I introduce a new kind of modern evil, administrative evil, that constitutes the foundation of complicity of the chain of political and military command in these abuses and tortures. Both public and private organizations, because they operate within a legal framework, not an ethical framework, can inflict suffering, even death, on people by following cold rationality for achieving the goals of their ideology, a master plan, a cost-benefit equation, or the bottom line of profit. Under those circumstances, their ends always justify efficient means. Investigations of Abu Ghraib abuses expose system faults. In response to numerous reports of abuse, not only at Abu Ghraib, but also at military prisons throughout Iraq, Afghanistan, and Cuba, the Pentagon has conducted at least a dozen official investigations. I closely reviewed half of them in preparation for my role in the defense of Sergeant Ivan Frederick. In this section, I will outline chronologically some of those key reports and highlight their conclusions with exact quotes from them. Doing so will give us a sense of how high-ranking officers and government officials evaluated the causes of torture and abuse. Because all but one of these investigations were ordered by the military with specific instructions to focus on perpetrators, most of them failed to indict military and political leaders for their roles in creating conditions conducive to these abuses. The only exception was the Schlesinger Report ordered by Secretary Rumsfeld. By looking down rather than up the chain of command, these reports are limited in scope and neither as independent nor as nonpartisan as one would wish. However, they provide us with a starting point in our case against the military and administration chains of command that we will then supplement with additional media and agency reports complemented by first-hand testimonies of soldiers involved in torture. For a full chronology of the Abu Ghraib abuses and investigative reports, please see the website. The Ryder Report was the first to send up warning signals. The Army's chief law enforcement officer, Provost Marshal Donald Ryder, a major general, prepared the first report, November 6, 2003, by order of General Sanchez. Ryder was appointed in August to head an assessment team as requested by the Army Criminal Investigation Unit. That unit is identified as CTJF-7, Combined Joint Task Force 7, a multi-service and Department of Defense, DOD, task force that included Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, and DOD civilian staff. This document reviewed the entire prison system in Iraq and recommended ways to improve it. At the end, Ryder concluded that there had been serious human rights violations, as well as training and manpower inadequacies that were system-wide. His report also raised concerns about the fuzzy boundaries between the MPs, who were supposed only to guard prisoners, and the military intelligence, MI, teams assigned to interrogate prisoners. It noted that the MIs tried to enlist the MPs to engage in activities that would prepare detainees for interrogation. This MI-MP tension dated back to the Afghanistan War, during which MPs worked with MIs to set favorable conditions for subsequent interviews, a euphemism for breaking the will of prisoners. Ryder called for the establishment of procedures to define the role of military police soldiers, clearly separating the actions of the guards from those of the military intelligence personnel. His report should have put on notice all those in charge of the military's prison systems. Despite this valuable contribution, Ryder undercut his warning, according to the journalist Seymour Hersh, by concluding that the situation had not yet reached a crisis point. Though some procedures were flawed, he said, he found no military police units purposely applying inappropriate confinement practices. Remember that this report appeared at the height of the most flagrant abuses going on in Tier 1A during the fall of 2003, but before Specialist Joe Darby's exposé, January 13, 2004. Hersh's New Yorker magazine article, May 5, 2004, which broke open the scandal, concluded about the Ryder report that his investigation was at best a failure and at worst a cover-up. The Taguba report is thorough and tough. Once the notorious photos surfaced among military higher-ups and the criminal investigating team in January 2004, General Sanchez was forced to move beyond Ryder's whitewash job. He assigned Major General Antonio M. Taguba to do a fuller investigation into allegations of detainee abuse, undocumented prisoner escapes, and widespread failures in discipline and accountability. Taguba did an admirable job in a detailed, extensive investigation that was published in March 2004. although it was intended to remain classified because it made direct accusations of officer dereliction of duty, leveled other strong charges against fellow officers, and contained as evidence some of the photos, it was too juicy not to be leaked to the media, probably for big bucks. The Taguba report was leaked to The New Yorker, where its main findings and the photos were published in Hirsch's story, but this occurred only after the photos were also leaked to the producers of 60 Minutes 2 and shown in its April 28, 2004 broadcast. You will recall that this was what started me on this adventure. Taguba wasted no time in refuting his fellow general's report. Unfortunately, many of the systemic problems that surfaced during Ryder's assessment are the very same issues that are the subject of this investigation, he wrote. In fact, many of the abuses suffered by detainees occurred during or near to the time of that assessment. The report continued, contrary to the findings of MG, Major General Ryder's report, I find that personnel assigned to the 372nd MP Company, 800th MP Brigade, were directed to change facility procedures to set the conditions for MI interrogations. His report made it clear that Army intelligence officers, CIA agents, private contractors, and OGAs, other government agencies, actively requested that MP guards set physical and mental conditions for favorable interrogation of witnesses. In support of this assertion, Taguba cited sworn statements from several guards about the complicity of the military intelligence personnel and of the interrogators. SPC Specialist Sabrina Harmon, 372nd MP Company, stated in her sworn statement regarding the incident where a detainee was placed on a box with wires attached to his fingers, toes, and penis, that her job was to keep detainees awake. She said that MI was talking to CPL, Corporal Grainer. She stated, MI wanted to get them to talk. It is Grainer and Frederick's job to do things for MI and OGA to get these people to talk. Taguba presented testimony from Sergeant Javal Davis about what he observed regarding the influence of military intelligence and OGAs on the MP guards. I witnessed prisoners in the MI hold section, Wing 1A, being made to do various things that I would question morally. In Wing 1A, we were told that they had different rules and different SOP, standard operating procedures, for treatment. I never saw a set of rules or SOP for that section, just word of mouth. The soldier in charge of 1A was Corporal Grainer. He stated that the agents and MI soldiers would ask him to do things, but nothing was ever in writing, he would complain. When asked why the rules in 1A, 1B were different than those in the rest of the wings, Sergeant Davis stated, the rest of the wings are regular prisoners, and 1AB are military intelligence, MI holds. When asked why he did not inform his chain of command about this abuse, Sergeant Davis stated, because I assumed that if they were doing things out of the ordinary or outside the guidelines, someone would have said something. Observe the evil of inaction at work again. Also, the wing belongs to MI, and it appeared MI personnel approved of the abuse. Sergeant Davis also stated that he had heard MI insinuate to the guards to abuse the inmates. When asked what MI said, he stated, loosen this guy up for us. Make sure he has a bad night. Make sure he gets the treatment. He claimed these comments were made to Corporal Grainer and Sergeant Frederick. Finally, Sergeant Davis stated that the MI staffs, to my understanding, have been giving Grainer compliments on the way he has been handling the MI holds. Examples being statements like, good job, they're breaking down real fast. They answer every question. They're giving out good information, finally. And keep up the good work. Stuff like that. Reminiscent of my SPE guards taking away the prisoners' mattresses, sheets, clothes, and pillows for rule violations, is the statement made to Taguba by Specialist Jason Kennel, 372nd MP Company. I saw them nude, but MI would tell us to take away their mattresses, sheets, and clothes. He could not recall who in MI had instructed him to do this, but commented that, if they wanted me to do that, they needed to give me paperwork. He was later informed that, We could not do anything to embarrass the prisoners. This is just one example of the continuous inconsistencies between the reality of the abusive situation and the unofficial encouragement of the MPs to abuse detainees by MIs and other agents on that tier. As they gave orders for abuse spoken from one side of the mouth, the official public statement from the other side of the mouth insisted that, "We do not condone prisoner abuse or anything but their humane treatment." Such an approach created the case for plausible deniability later on. Also of passing interest in establishing parallels with the SPE is the Taguba Report's emphasis on the need for uniformity in the counts. Recall the central role that the counts came to play as occasions for abuse of our SPE prisoners. There is a lack of standardization in the way the 320th MP Battalion conducted physical counts of their detainees. The report goes on to complain of the lack of count standardization. Each compound within a given encampment did their head counts differently. Some compounds had detainees line up in lines of 10, some had them sit in rows, and some moved all the detainees to one end of the compound and counted them as they passed to the other end of the compound. The Taguba report specifies that top military leaders who were made aware of extreme detainee abuse had recommended court-martial, but they never followed through. Their inaction, given their awareness of the abuses, thereby strengthened the impression that there would be no payback for abusing prisoners. Another obvious example of the brigade leadership not communicating with its soldiers or ensuring their tactical proficiency concerns the incident of detainee abuse that occurred at Camp Buka, Iraq, on May 12, 2003. An extensive CID, Criminal Investigative Division, investigation determined that four soldiers from the 320th MP Battalion had kicked and beaten these detainees following a transport mission from Talil Air Base. Formal charges under the UCMJ were preferred against these soldiers, and an Article 32 investigation conducted by LTC Lieutenant Colonel Gentry. He recommended a general court-martial for the four accused, which BG, Brigadier General, Karpinski supported. Despite this documented abuse, there is no evidence that BG Karpinski ever attempted to remind 800th MP soldiers of the requirements of the Geneva Conventions regarding detainee treatment or took any steps to ensure that such abuse was not repeated. Nor is there any evidence that LTC P. Philibom, the commander of the soldiers involved in the Camp Buka abuse case, took any initiative to ensure his soldiers were properly trained regarding detainee treatment. What we have here is a failure to communicate, to educate, and to provide leadership. Taguba offers many instances of ways in which the soldiers and Army Reserve MPs were not properly trained and were not given the resources and information they needed to perform their difficult functions as guards in Abu Ghraib prison. The report states, "There is a general lack of knowledge, implementation, and emphasis of basic legal, regulatory, doctrinal, and command requirements within the 800th MP Brigade and its subordinate units. The handling of detainees and criminal prisoners after in-processing was inconsistent from detention facility to detention facility, compound to compound, encampment to encampment, and even shift to shift throughout the 800th MP Brigade AOR, Area of Responsibility." Italics added to emphasize shift differences from day to night on Tier 1A. The report also states, "The Abu Ghraib and Camp Buka detention facilities are significantly over their intended maximum capacity, while the guard force is undermanned and under-resourced. This imbalance has contributed to the poor living conditions, escapes, and accountability lapses at the various facilities. The overcrowding of the facilities also limits the ability to identify and segregate leaders in the detainee population who may be organizing escapes and riots within the facility." The report goes on to identify one of the problems raised by Chip Frederick in policing his tier, that of numerous unidentified civilians and unknown others coming and going, and giving orders to him and his staff. In general, U.S. civilian contract personnel, Titan Corporation, CACI, etc., third country nationals and local contractors do not appear to be properly supervised within the detention facility at Abu Ghraib. During our on-site inspection, they wandered about with too much unsupervised free access in the detainee area. Having civilians in various outfits, civilian and DCUs, desert camouflage units, in and about the detainee area causes confusion and may have contributed to the difficulties in the accountability process and with detecting escapes. Taguba documents many instances of prisoners escaping and rioting and describes lethal encounters between MPs and detainees. In every case, the report repeats its conclusion. No information on findings, contributing factors, or corrective action has been provided to this investigation team. The report also takes note of one major prisoner riot that had lethal consequences, one of those that Chip Frederick mentioned as a prelude to a transfer to his Tier 1A of the riot ringleaders, who were then abused there. 24 November 03, riot and shooting of 12 detainees. Several detainees allegedly began to riot at about 1300 in all of the compounds at the Gansi encampment. This resulted in the shooting deaths of 3 detainees, 9 wounded detainees, and 9 injured U.S. soldiers. A 15-6 investigation by Colonel Bruce Falcone, 220th MP Brigade Deputy Commander, concluded that the detainees rioted in protest of their living conditions, that the riot turned violent, the use of non-lethal force was ineffective, and after the 320th MP Battalion CDR Commander executed Golden Spike, the emergency containment plan, the use of deadly force was authorized. What or who was to blame for this riot and the use of deadly force to contain it? Taguba concludes that a host of problems were involved. He notes, contributing factors were lack of comprehensive training of guards, poor or non-existent SOPs, no formal guard count conducted prior to shift, no rehearsals or ongoing training, the mix of less than lethal rounds with lethal rounds in weapons, no AARs, after-action reports, being conducted after incidents, ROE, rules of engagement, not posted and not understood, overcrowding, uniforms not standardized, and poor communication between the command and soldiers. Taguba was especially concerned at the obviously inadequate training of the MP Brigade, well known by military command, was never corrected. I find that the 800th MP Brigade was not adequately trained for a mission that included operating a prison or penal institution at Abu Ghraib Prison Complex. As the writer assessment found, I also concur that units of the 800th MP Brigade did not receive corrections-specific training during their mobilization period. MP units did not receive pinpoint assignments prior to mobilization and during the post-mobilization training, and thus could not train for specific missions. The training that was accomplished at the mobilization sites were developed and implemented at the company level with little or no direction or supervision at the battalion and brigade levels, and consisted primarily of common tasks and law enforcement training. However, I found no evidence that the command, although aware of this deficiency, ever requested specific corrections training from the commandant of the military police school, the U.S. Army confinement facility at Mannheim, Germany, the provost marshal general of the Army, or the U.S. Army disciplinary barracks at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. This investigation indicates that B.G. Karpinski and her staff did a poor job allocating resources throughout the Iraq JOA, Joint Operations Area. Abu Ghraib, BCCF, Baghdad Central Confinement Facility, normally housed between 6,000 and 7,000 detainees, yet it was operated by only one battalion. In contrast, the HVD, High Visibility Detainees Facility, maintains only about 100 detainees and is also run by an entire battalion. In addition to being severely undermanned, the quality of life for soldiers assigned to Abu Ghraib, BCCF, was extremely poor. There was no DFAC, dining facility, PX, post-exchange, barbershop, or MWR, morale, welfare, and recreation facilities. There were numerous mortar attacks, random rifle and RPG, rocket-propelled grenade attacks, and a serious threat to soldiers and detainees in the facility. The prison complex was also severely overcrowded, and the brigade lacked adequate resources and personnel to resolve serious logistical problems. Finally, because of past associations and familiarity of soldiers within the brigade, it appears that friendship often took precedence over appropriate leader and subordinate relationships. Taguba targets derelict, deficient commanders. One of the exceptional features of General Taguba's report, compared with all the other investigations into the Abu Ghraib abuses, is its willingness to identify the commanders who failed to exercise their military leadership, and who deserve some form of military punishment. It is worth our time to lay out some of the reasons that the general targeted many military leaders for their roles in creating a command that was a mockery rather than a model of military leadership. These were the leaders who were supposed to provide the disciplinary structure for the hapless MPs. With respect to the 800th MP Brigade mission at Abu Ghraib, BCCF, I find that there was clear friction and lack of effective communication between the commander, 205th MI Brigade, who controlled FOB, Forward Operations Base, Abu Ghraib, BCCF, after 19 November 2003, and the commander, 800th MP Brigade, who controlled detainee operations inside the FOB. There was no clear delineation of responsibility between commands, little coordination at the command level, and no integration of the two functions. Coordination occurred at the lowest possible levels with little oversight by commanders. The 320th MP Battalion was stigmatized as a unit due to previous detainee abuse which occurred in May 2003 at the Buka Theater Internment Facility, TIF, while under the command of LTC P. Philibom. Despite his proven deficiencies as both a commander and leader, B.G. Karpinski allowed LTC P. Philibom to remain in command of her most troubled battalion, guarding by far the largest number of detainees in the 800th MP Brigade. Numerous witnesses stated that the 800th MP Brigade, S1, Major Hensman, and S4, Major Green, were essentially dysfunctional, but that despite numerous complaints, these officers were not replaced. This had a detrimental effect on the brigade staff's effectiveness and morale. Moreover, the brigade command judge advocate, LTC James O'Hare, appears to lack initiative and was unwilling to accept responsibility for any of his actions. LTC Gary Maddox, the brigade XO, executive officer, did not properly supervise the brigade staff by failing to lay out staff priorities, take overt corrective action when needed, and supervise their daily functions. In addition, numerous officers and senior NCOs have been reprimanded, disciplined for misconduct during this period. From my reading of Taguba's analysis, I must conclude that Abu Ghraib was an animal house at the officer level, as well as among the night shift Army Reserve MPs on Tier 1A. 12 officers and NCOs were reprimanded or disciplined, mildly, for their misconduct, dereliction of duty, lack of leadership, and alcohol abuse. One glaring example involved Captain Leo Merck, commander of the 870th MP Company, who was alleged to have taken nude photographs of his own female soldiers without their knowledge. A second example involved NCOs who were found derelict in duty for fraternizing with junior commissioned officers and for gratuitously shooting off their M16 rifles while exiting their cars, unintentionally and negligently blowing up a fuel tank. Taguba recommended that a dozen of the individuals in command positions, who should have been positive role models for the ordinary soldiers and reservists functioning under them, deserve to be relieved from command or relieved from duty and given a general officer memorandum of reprimand. His report cites many specific instances of failure of leadership for each of the following principles. Brigadier General Janice L. Karpinski, Commander, 800th MP Brigade. Colonel Thomas M. Pappas, Commander, 205th MI Brigade. Lieutenant Colonel P. Jerry L. Philibom, Commander, 320th MP Battalion. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen L. Jordan, former Director, Joint Interrogation and Debriefing Center, and Liaison Officer to 205th MI Brigade. Major David W. Denena, S3, 320th MP Battalion, and Captain Donald J. Reese, Commander, 372nd MP Company. Other lower-level officers also cited by Taguba are important for their positions in Tier 1A. They include 1st Lieutenant Louis C. Rader, Platoon Leader, 372nd MP Company, Sergeant Major Mark Emerson, Operations Sergeant Major, 320th MP Battalion, 1st Sergeant Brian G. Lipinski, 372nd MP Company, and Sergeant 1st Class Shannon K. Snyder, Platoon Sergeant, 372nd MP Company. The Taguba report issued a common justification for reprimanding those who should have been in charge of operations at Tier 1A, Reese, Rader, Emerson, Lipinski, and Snyder. Each of them was charged with one or more of the following: failing to ensure that soldiers under his direct command knew and understood the protections afforded to detainees in the Geneva Convention relative to the treatment of prisoners of war. Failing to properly supervise his soldiers working and visiting Tier 1 of the hard site at Abu Ghraib, BCCF. Failing to properly establish and enforce basic soldier standards, proficiency, and accountability. Failing to ensure that soldiers under his direct command were properly trained in internment and resettlement operations. Here, then, is further support for the pleadings made by Chip Frederick and other MP guards on his shift that they were essentially clueless as to what was appropriate and what was not acceptable when preparing detainees for interrogation. However, culpability lay not just with the military. This investigation also shows that several civilian interrogators and interpreters who wrongly involved the MPs in their interrogation of detainees on Tier 1A were personally implicated in the abuse. Among them, the Taguba report identifies the following culprits: Stephen Stefanowitz, contract U.S. civilian interrogator, CACI, 205th Military Intelligence Brigade, and John Israel, contract U.S. civilian interpreter, CACI, 205th Military Intelligence Brigade. Stefanowitz is accused of having allowed and or instructed MPs who were not trained in interrogation techniques to facilitate interrogations by setting conditions which were neither authorized and in accordance with applicable regulations/policy. He clearly knew his instructions equated to physical abuse. That is exactly what Frederick and Grainer reported that they had been encouraged to do by these civilians who seemed to be in charge of the main action of Tier 1A, to get actionable intelligence through detainee interrogation by any means necessary. The effect of the negative modeling of the evil of inaction is also revealed by Taguba's admonition of Sergeant Snyder for failing to report a soldier who, under his direct control, abused detainees by stomping on their bare hands and feet in his presence. Before we leave the Taguba report to move on to some of the findings in several other independent investigations, we must note its powerful conclusion about the culpability of some military officers and civilian workers who have not yet been tried or even charged for the abuses at Abu Ghraib. Several U.S. Army soldiers have committed egregious acts and grave breaches of international law at Abu Ghraib/BCCF and Camp Buka, Iraq. Furthermore, key senior leaders in both the 800th MP Brigade and the 205th MI Brigade failed to comply with established regulations, policies, and command directives in preventing detainee abuses at Abu Ghraib, BCCF, and at Camp Buka during the period August 2003 to February 2004. Specifically, I suspect that Colonel Thomas M. Pappas, LTC Steve L. Jordan, Mr. Steven Stefanowitz, and Mr. John Israel were either directly or indirectly responsible for abuses at Abu Ghraib, BCCF, and strongly recommend immediate disciplinary action as described in the preceding paragraphs, as well as the initiation of a Procedure 15 inquiry to determine the full extent of their culpability. The Milalashek Report blames only the few. Lieutenant General Paul T. Milalashek, Army Inspector General, reviewed 94 confirmed cases of detainee abuse in Afghanistan and Iraq and the conditions contributing to these violations of U.S. military policy. The report was issued on February 10, 2004. Even though the report identifies the many instances of flawed decisions by senior commanders and military officers that contributed to the abuses, General Milalashek concluded that the abuses did not result from any military policy, nor were they the fault of any senior officers. Instead, he turned his blame laser on only low-ranking soldiers for committing these abuses. Let Milalashek's record show that these 94 cases of detainee abuse in military prisons in Afghanistan and Iraq were due simply to the unauthorized actions taken by a few individuals. Thus, the Inspector General cleanly absolved the entire chain of command of any responsibility for the damages. The 94 cases of abuse also go far beyond the confines of the night shift on Tier 1A. This top-level whitewash should be packaged with the Ryder Report as a Tweedledee-Tweedledum boxed set. However, before moving on, it is valuable to set this general's conclusion of no top dogs responsible against inconsistencies in his report's other findings. The report notes that troops received ambiguous guidance from command on the treatment of detainees, and further, that established interrogation policies were not clear and contained ambiguity. It also notes that the decision by senior commanders in Iraqi prisons to rely on the Guantanamo Bay Prison, Gitmo, guidelines was wrong. The detainees at Gitmo were considered high-value alien combatants who may have had actionable intelligence necessary to extract in order to combat terrorism and insurgency. Secretary Rumsfeld outlined a set of stiff interrogation tactics to be used on those detainees. However, they were somehow transported overseas to Iraq prisons and to run-of-the-mill detainees. Milalashek's report states that this action by senior military officers appears to contradict the terms of Rumsfeld's decision, which explicitly stated that the guidelines were applicable only to interrogations at Guantanamo, and this led to the use of high-risk interrogation techniques that left considerable room for misapplication, particularly under high-stress combat conditions. The Faye Jones Report scales the blame upward and outward. Lieutenant General Anthony R. Jones assisted Major General George R. Faye in leading an investigation of allegations that the 205th Military Intelligence Brigade was involved in detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib. They also investigated whether any organizations or personnel higher than that brigade command were involved in those abuses in any way. Although their report advances the standard dispositional attribution of putting the blame on the individual perpetrators of the abuses, once again that small groups of morally corrupt soldiers and civilians, it does extend the causation to situational and systemic factors in revealing ways. The events at Abu Ghraib cannot be understood in a vacuum, is the Faye Jones lead-in to outlining how the operational environment contributed to those abuses. Compatible with the social psychological analysis that I have been proposing, their report goes on to detail both the powerful situational and systemic forces operating within and around the behavioral setting. Consider the significance of the following three paragraphs extracted from the final report. LTG Jones found that while senior-level officers did not commit the abuse at Abu Ghraib, they did bear responsibility for lack of oversight of the facility failing to respond in a timely manner to the reports of the International Committee of the Red Cross, and for issuing policy memos that failed to provide clear, consistent guidance for execution at the tactical level. M.G. Fay has found that from 25 July 2003 to 6 February 2004, 27 205 MIBDE Brigade personnel allegedly requested, encouraged, condoned, or solicited military police, MP personnel, to abuse detainees and or participated in detainee abuse and or violated established interrogation procedures and applicable laws and regulations during interrogation operations at Abu Ghraib. The leaders from units located at Abu Ghraib or with supervision over soldiers and units at Abu Ghraib failed to supervise subordinates or provide direct oversight of this important mission. These leaders failed to properly discipline their soldiers. These leaders failed to learn from their mistakes and failed to provide continued mission-specific training. The absence of effective leadership was a factor in not sooner discovering and taking actions to prevent both the violent sexual abuse incidents and the misinterpretation confusion incidents. Abuses would not have occurred had doctrine been followed and mission training conducted. The joint report of these generals summarizes multiple factors that they found as having contributed to the abuses at Abu Ghraib. 7 factors are identified as primary contributors to the abuses. Individual criminal propensities, the alleged dispositions of the reserve MPs. Leadership failures, systemic factors. Dysfunctional command relationships at brigade and higher echelons, systemic factors. Multiple agencies, organizations' involvement in interrogation operations at Abu Ghraib, systemic factors. Failure to effectively screen, certify, and then interrogate contractor interrogators, analysts, linguists, systemic factor. Lack of a clear understanding of the MP and MI roles and responsibilities in interrogation operations, situational and systemic factors. Lack of safety and security at Abu Ghraib, situational and systemic factors. The Fay-Jones report thus specifies 6 of 7 contributing factors to the abuses as traceable to systemic or situational factors, and but 1 to dispositional factors. It then proceeds to expand on this overview by highlighting numerous systemic failures that played key roles in facilitating the abuses. Looking beyond personal responsibility, leader responsibility, and command responsibility, systemic problems and issues also contributed to the volatile environment in which abuse occurred. The report lists several dozen specific systemic failures ranging from doctrine and policy concerns to leadership and command and control issues to resource and training issues. Cooperating with illegal CIA activities as teamwork. I was surprised to discover in this report open public criticism of the CIA's role in the abuse of interrogations, which was supposed to be clandestine. The systematic lack of accountability for interrogator actions and detainees plagued detainee operations at Abu Ghraib. It is unclear how and under what authority the CIA could place prisoners like detainee 28 in Abu Ghraib because no memorandums of understanding existed on the subject between the CIA and CJTF-7. We will have more to say about this detainee, Manidel al-Jamadi, later on. Local CIA officers convinced Colonel Pappas and LTC Jordan that they should be allowed to operate outside the established local rules and procedures. Let's pause for a moment to let that statement resonate before considering how this matter of the military's links with the CIA was resolved. Fay Jones noted that when Colonel Pappas raised the issue of CIA use of Abu Ghraib with Colonel Blotz, Colonel Blotz encouraged Colonel Pappas to cooperate with the CIA because everyone was all one team. Colonel Blotz directed LTC Jordan to cooperate as well. creating an unhealthy work environment. The way in which such above and beyond the law undercover work by CIA operatives contributed to a cancerous environment is elaborated in Faye Jones with a psychological analysis. The death of detainee 28 and incidents such as the loaded weapon in the interrogation room were widely known within the U.S. community, MI and MP alike, at Abu Ghraib. Speculation and resentment grew out of a lack of personal responsibility, of some people being above the laws and regulations. The resentment contributed to the unhealthy environment that existed at Abu Ghraib. The death of detainee 28 remains unresolved. The operational use of anonymity as a protective shield to get away with murder is noted in passing. CIA officers operating at Abu Ghraib used aliases and never revealed their true names. When the self-serving claims of the MPs turn out to be true. The Faye Jones investigation offers support for the claims by Chip Frederick and other night shift MPs that many of their abusive actions were encouraged and supported by a variety of individuals working for military intelligence in their unit. The MPs being prosecuted claim that their actions came at the direction of MI. Although self-serving, these claims do have some basis in fact. The environment created at Abu Ghraib contributed to the occurrence of such abuse and the fact that it remained undiscovered by higher authority for a long period of time. What started out as nakedness and humiliation, stress and physical training, exercise, carried over into sexual and physical assaults by a small group of morally corrupt and unsupervised soldiers and civilians. These investigating generals repeatedly make evident the major roles played by systemic and situational factors in the abuses. However, they cannot give up the dispositional attribution of the perpetrators as the few morally corrupt individuals, the so-called bad apples, in an otherwise flawless barrel filled to the brim with the noble conduct of the vast majority of our soldiers. Decent dogs doing dirty deeds. The Faye Jones report was one of the first to detail and fault some of the accepted tactics used to facilitate effective interrogations. For example, it notes that the use of dogs was imported by Major General Jeffrey Miller from Gitmo Prison in Cuba, but the report adds, "The use of dogs in interrogations to fear up detainees was utilized without proper authorization." Once muzzled dogs were officially made available to induce fear in prisoners, it did not take long to unofficially unmuzzle them in order to rev up the fear factor. The Faye Jones report identifies a civilian interrogator, number 21, a private CACI employee, who used an unmuzzled dog during an interrogation and who yelled to MPs where a dog was being used against a detainee to take him home. To show that the dogs could chew things up, that dog had just torn apart the detainee's mattress. Another interrogator, Soldier 17, 2nd MI Battalion, is accused of failing to report the improper use of dogs that he saw when the handler allowed the dog to go nuts in scaring two juvenile detainees by sending an unmuzzled dog into their cell. This interrogator also failed to report the dog handlers discussing their competition to scare detainees to the point that they would defecate in their pants. They claim to have already made several detainees urinate on themselves when threatened by their dogs. Naked prisoners are dehumanized prisoners. The use of nudity as an incentive to maintain detainee cooperation was imported from prisons in Afghanistan and Guantanamo. When it came time to use that tactic at Abu Ghraib, the Faye Jones report noted, "The lines of authority and the proper legal opinions blurred. They simply carried forward the use of nudity into the Iraqi theater of operations. The use of clothing as an incentive, nudity, is significant in that it likely contributed to an escalating dehumanization of the detainees and set the stage for additional and more severe abuses to occur by the MPs. When segregation becomes isolation. Although Lieutenant General Sanchez had approved the tactic of isolation over extended periods of time for specific detainees, it appears that he really meant segregation of them from fellow prisoners. However, at the Abu Ghraib hard site, Sanchez was taken at his word, and many detainees were totally isolated and completely removed from all outside contact, as in solitary confinement, other than the required care and feeding by MP guards and interrogation by MI. The Faye Jones report notes that these cells had limited or poor ventilation, no light, and were often made excessively hot or cold. Use of isolation rooms in the Abu Ghraib hard site was not closely controlled or monitored. Lacking proper training, clear guidance, or experience in this technique, both MP and MI stretched the bounds into further abuse, sensory deprivation, and unsafe or unhealthy living conditions. Assigning blame. Officers, MI, interrogators, analysts, interpreters, translators, and medics. The Faye Jones report concludes by declaring as culpable all those its investigation found responsible for detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib, fully 27 individuals by name or identity code. What is significant to me is the number of people who knew of the abuses, witnessed them, even participated in them in various ways, and did nothing to prevent, stop, or report them. They provided social proof to the MPs that it was acceptable to continue doing whatever they wanted to do. Their smiling, silent faces provided social support from the surrounding network of the general interrogation team that gave thumbs up to abuses that should have received reprimands. Once again, we see the evil of inaction facilitating the evil of action. Medics and nurses often were guilty of not helping victims in distress, of observing brutality and looking the other way, and worse. They signed off on false death certificates and lied about the nature of wounds and broken limbs. They violated their Hippocratic Oath and sold their souls for dross, according to Professor of Medicine and Bioethics Stephen H. Miles, in his book, Oath Betrayed. At the top of the Faye Jones blame list is again the inept Colonel Pappas, with 12 separate charges against him, and again Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Jordan, director of the Joint Interrogation Debriefing Center. The following officers, not on Taguba's hit list, are singled out by Faye and Jones as also culpable. Major David Price, operations officer at that center. Major Michael Thompson, Deputy Operations Officer at that center, and Captain Carolyn Wood, Officer in Charge of Interrogation Control Element, ICE, at that center. Before reviewing some of the reprehensible actions of the lower-level cast of characters who played both directors and audience for the Abu Ghraib 7 perpetrators, it is well to stop for a moment to consider the fate of Captain Carolyn Wood. As leader of the 519th Military Intelligence Brigade when she was only a lieutenant, Wood had an important role to play, but she misplayed it badly. At Bagram Prison in Afghanistan, Wood authorized new, tougher interrogation guidelines that somehow ended up in detainees being severely beaten.